To another episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast with me, Craig Barton, the show where I interview people from the wonderful world of education who interest and inspire me. Now, this episode marks the first in season 3 of my Research in Action series. I'll tell you all about that in a few moments, but first, a quick word from our lovely sponsors. Cue the fancy music. This episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast is proudly supported by our good friends at AQA. Now, AQA have a brand new campaign that I'm dead excited about. It's called Questions Matter, and it features stories of teachers and ordinary people sharing the pivotal question their mentor asked them and how it changed the course of their lives. Now, here's a question that I ask each day that has quite literally changed my life. And the question is, what was one good thing that happened today? Now, I used to ask that to myself, and now I ask it to my 4-year-old, Isaac, just before he goes to sleep, and he asks the question back to me. And I find that question, what was the one good thing that happened today, stops me agonizing over that one bad lesson, that single daft mistake, that silly argument, and instead it gets me thinking about something good. I really recommend you try it. But enough about me. The most important question AQA asks is, how can an exam board help you get the best out of your learners? AQA have built their GCSE maths on 3 things we know matter to you, and that's support, evidence, and fairness. So for support, AQA offers resources that you can tailor to your needs in one place to save you time. For evidence, AQA has maths experts in world-leading research, many of whom are teachers, to design assessments for today and for the future. And if you'd listened to my Inside Exams podcast, you'll have heard from some of those experts. And finally, fairness. AQA have listened to feedback and changed their maths GCSE papers for 2023 to make them fairer so your learners get to show their true ability. If you want to know more about AQA's Questions Matter campaign, then there is a website that's at aqa.org.uk/questions-matter. And there'll be a link to that in the show notes. Yes, welcome again to season 3 of my Research in Action mini-series, where I interview researchers from Loughborough University's Centre for Mathematical Cognition about their chosen area of interest and research and the implication for teachers in the classroom. And most importantly of all, I try my very best not to come across completely out of my depth. Now, for this season, we have 6 episodes, and my plan is to release one every Thursday to take us through the summer holidays. We start with the fantastic Paul Howard Jones and a discussion about how and why teachers do, and more often don't, use research in their practice. It's a good one, this one. Now, when recording these episodes, I'd actually lost my voice, so apologies in advance for the croakiness, coughs, and occasional shifts in pitch. I think a squeak on several occasions. Enjoy. Well, it gives me tremendous pleasure to welcome Paul Howard Jones to the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast. How are you, Paul?
I'm very good, thank you, Craig.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. And to start off, can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself, please?
About myself? Well, So I started off as a design and technology teacher, actually. Woodwork, metalwork, that sort of thing. But I was also, I'd done a PhD in physics, and I was doing a degree in psychology. And I had a chance to start doing some educational research when I started training teachers. And I got offered a small grant to start imaging people's brains. And I got into neuroscience, psychology, bringing that into educational research, and I've ended up here at Bristol University, where I am now, as a professor of neuroscience and education. So there you are. It's a potted history.
Amazing. Love it. Okay, well, before we dive into the research specifically, math speed dating question. So you'll be loving these, Paul. Question number one, favourite number and why?
Oh, well, I don't know. I suppose I've always liked 7 because it's a prime number. It doesn't seem to be. I mean, it seems to be completely individual. You know what I mean? It's a single-digit prime number. And I just like that idea. You can't split it up into its components.
Nice. Like it. Speed dating question number two. What was your favourite topic in maths as a student?
I suppose I got a lot of pleasure out of differentiation. Sat to the thumb. Never said that before. I used to find it very mysterious, all those symbols. I've always been a bit of a romantic. I love this idea of symbols and a mysterious language. So I thought calculus was pretty cool, really. It was something, you know, you could write down, your mum and dad would have no idea what you were talking about.
Good answer. I like it. And speed dating question number three, what job would you like to do if you weren't involved in education and research?
I think I would like to be helping to set up a sustainable farm.
Good one. I like this, Paul. This has got the strong answers, these. I like this.
Yeah, I'm thinking on the spot because I ought to point out to your listeners, I failed to read the briefing, so this is completely live and spontaneous.
It's what we like. It's our best episodes with those. I like that, Paul. Okay. We have one extra question, actually, before we dive into the kind of research.
Oh, and that God, is a favourite. That's the one where the detective turns around, isn't it? Just
exactly.
One more question.
Columbo, here we come. That's it. So this one, yeah, this will be interesting off the cuff. Favourite failure. So something perhaps from your research or career that didn't go according to plan, but you learned something valuable from the experience.
I got kicked out of Oxford.
Here we go.
I'm not sure that I can tell your listeners about myself and the rector's daughter. But no, unfortunately, it wasn't that. I wish it was in a way, but it wasn't. No, I just I failed my end of year exams. They called them prelims. I was studying chemistry. And I think I'd set off down that road. I really had this thing about going to Oxbridge because my brother had been to Oxford, and I was told I'd be lucky to pass my physics GCSE. And I had something to prove. And I really sort of thought, you know, I really worked hard to get to Lincoln College, Oxford, studying chemistry. But actually, that's not a very good reason to do anything. I think that's what I learned, really. You have to follow your passions. Don't set out just trying to prove something, which is what I did, because then I found out that actually at university anyway I found chemistry a little bit boring. I'm glad to say that. Okay.
Good answer. I like that. That was good. Couldn't have been better if you'd planned that. That was very good, that, Paul. I like it. Right. Let's dive in then to your chosen area of research that you want to talk about today. So do you want to give us a bit of an overview, kind of what attracted you to it, why you feel it's important, and then let's go from there.
Yeah, I think, I'm working for the Centre for Early Maths Learning, CEML, which is a new centre that's started up. And at first I wasn't quite sure why I was working for them. My life and my career has generally been very random, so I often find myself doing things I didn't expect to be doing because I'm not a maths specialist. But it turns out the reason why they sort of wanted me in was because I'm quite interested in communication with teachers, and I am very interested in that. And so what I've been doing in my first year with CEML has been looking at the journey that some teachers take in using educational research in their practice. And I think it's not just me that's looking at this. And one of the things I've discovered is quite a few people asking the same question, really, is how, why, and sometimes why not, you know, why does research not actually arrive in the classroom? So there's lots of researchers around the world doing wonderful things, discovering stuff. But you know, the journey from that into practice in a classroom seems to be strained and a bit problematic, because not very much research actually reaches the classroom.
It's really interesting, this. When Colin sent through the kind of briefings of the kind of things that the guests were going to be talking about on this series, this one really struck me, this, because I'm fascinated by this. And just a bit of background from my end, Paul, I taught for 12 years without reading any research whatsoever. It just didn't even come onto my radar that might be a sensible thing to do. And then when I had kind of a mid-career crisis, I then read everything. Well, I say everything. I got everything that I could get my hands on, particularly with regard to memory, that really interested me, cognitive load, problem solving, that kind of thing. And it fascinates me why I didn't for the first 12 years. But then also the thing that I think interests me more now is what type of research teachers tend to latch onto. And I wonder, yeah, well, what's your kind of theory of why research doesn't perhaps kind of play out as much as people like you would hope it would in the classroom? Any thoughts? What are the barriers?
Well, I think the way that we tried to frame it, because we've been looking at the underlying processes and trying to explain what happens and what doesn't happen in terms of the underlying mental processes of the teacher. And you can think about it as if it happens, then you can think about it as a journey of six stages. And the first one is just being aware that the research is out there. So we call it engaging with the research, if you like. And actually, that's probably the one that researchers focus on most, because you've got people from both sides trying to make this happen. You've got senior leaders and you've got teachers who would like to know more. And you've got the researchers who really want to communicate what they're doing. And one of the things that the researchers often focus on is this engagement aspect. So just making sure that somehow their research is reaching their audience. Now, it could be a newsletter, it could be presentations as part of professional development, it could be writing a book. But, actually, from the teacher's perspective, are they aware of that piece of research? And there's all sorts of reasons, all sorts of things that might attract them to it. I mean, there's some very sort of visceral things like novelty, the rewards of being enriched, the fascination, the curiosity, if you like, that might draw teachers towards that. But actually, the research shows that teachers generally would rather take their research not from researchers, not from educational research journals, but from discussion with colleagues, professional magazines, popular media, and the types of professional development, which is most professional development, quite often, well, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of professional development, which is not actually research based. So there is, on the one hand, teachers are saying, yeah, research really interesting, can be really valuable. On the other hand, actually, the preference is to take it from and to engage with ideas, which are not necessarily rooted in educational research.
It's really interesting. You go on.
Well, I was just saying, even if people engage, even if the teachers do engage with it, so they're aware of it, they've then got to understand it, which is another thing entirely. Particularly from my area, because I work in neuroscience and education, there's a lot of neuromyth around. And sometimes in our effort to communicate new findings, we're just generating more of that misunderstanding. But we know, for example, that teachers often have difficulty with some of the concepts that underlie the research. So things like working memory and executive function. And we may be using words all the time that don't really translate. Effect size is another one, which is, commonly misunderstood. So the understanding is important. So let's imagine now that we've got a teacher who is aware of the research going on, that they understand the research, but then, they might understand, yeah, this is a really good thing. I can see how this might be valuable in the classroom, but they might not say it's for me. They might say this is not for me. Actually, it doesn't really chime with the sort of things that I believe are the biggest priority. And I think, one issue there is early years teachers in particular, the most important thing for them is the well-being of the child, you know, as it should be. And sometimes the sort of the academic or the ideas about how to push on academic achievement may or may not align with that desire first and foremost to think about the well-being of the child. So all I'm saying there is really it doesn't necessarily mean that just because a researcher has come up with a fantastic idea for boosting, you know, acquisition of knowledge about fractions or something like that, that teachers are going to respond and say, yeah, this is for me, this is what I'm going to prioritize, you know, I'm going to make sure, I'm going to put some time into making sure this is in my classroom. And there can be some good reasons for that. But then even if they've decided that they do value it, so they've become aware of it, they've understood it, and they think, yeah, this is actually, you know, a worthwhile thing to be doing in a classroom, they still may decide that they're not going to do it. The decision may not fall positively because, I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons for that. One of them can be confidence in one's ability to be able to implement it. But another important thing is just having the support around you. So, you know, are their colleagues doing it? Will the senior leadership be supporting them in doing this? Have they got the resources to be able to do it? So it's some very practical reasons as to why they might, you know, engage, understand and value something, but they still won't actually decide that they can do it. And then even if they do, they start implementing it, they're going to change it. They're going to have to adapt it, you know, in order to make it more suitable for their context, their classroom. And that can be more problematic than they'd anticipated. And quite often, there's quite often not the support provided for that adaptation process. In fact, you see, this is one of the problems with researchers and educators sometimes coming from different viewpoints, because the researcher is quite often really keen on validating and supporting some fundamental ideas about what's going on with a child learning maths. You know, it may be that they have a hypothesis about learning and they want to demonstrate that in action. So if they've developed an intervention which, you know, nominally is going to actually produce an improvement, they don't necessarily want that contaminated and interfered with too much, because actually it undermines the evidence they're trying to produce about what is going on theoretically. So they can put a lot of emphasis on fidelity. In other words, that the teachers are doing exactly what they've been asked to do in terms of the research intervention. But real life isn't like that. The teachers aren't so concerned with fidelity. What they want to, well, beyond the well-being of their child, they're going to be principally concerned about learning, and they're going to change, and they're going to take bits out of the intervention that they're not very happy about, and they're going to put bits that they do like into other things that they do, and the whole thing is going to possibly not resemble anything like the researcher originally imagined, and there's going to be all these other factors that are now involved that would make it very difficult to validate the original theoretical idea, if you like. But that is real life. So there's quite often not a support provided for educators by researchers to suggest how you might implement this and what can be changed and what can't be changed. Because a lot of adaptations are going to be positive. Some of them might be negative. But what's the best way to maximise the positivity of that adaptation? And then even if that all goes well, will it be sustained? Because teachers try things, maybe, maybe not. Another idea comes along, they might try that, you know, and the old one drops away. So there is still this issue of, you know, how does good practice, or how does, actually, never mind good practice, how does a practice become sustained? And I think one of the issues there is seeing that it's working, and the sorts of evidence that teachers might want may not arise very easily from that implementation. So, you know, what evidence is the actual research idea providing that it is working positively? And you also need support from your senior leadership and from other things that are going on around you to make sure that this becomes embedded as part of everyday practice. And of course, sometimes the evidence that leadership might require from something working may be different from what a teacher requires as well. Teachers may be looking at more intuitive, more observational sorts of evidence. So essentially, there's a very, it's quite an extended path. And at any point, people, teachers are going to be sort of dropping off that, quite often for good reasons. But you know, the question then becomes, how on earth does anything ever become such good practice? But we do, you know, we do see some things, some examples happening. We do see examples of some good practice becoming sustained, you know, it being implemented and becoming sustained. And interestingly, also bad practice as well.
This is fascinating. This, I love this. So just to recap this kind of, these kind of six stages, just to check I've got these right, and then I think we'll dig into each one. So teachers have got to be aware of the research first. They've got to understand the research. They've got to value it. They've got to implement it. Then some form of adaptation is probably going to occur. And then even if all that's looking good, they've then got to be able to sustain it. So as you say, yeah. I like these kind of big six that you've got to get through. I want to kind of dive straight in at number one here with the awareness. And I kind of alluded to this a little earlier. Do you get a sense, Paul, that teachers are more aware of some kind of types of research than others, or genres of research? Or what are the types of research that teachers are more aware of? Is there any trends that you've picked up on there?
Well, I think brokers are really important in this.
Yeah.
The research that teachers are likely to take on board are those pieces of understanding, those findings that arise from brokers that they trust, and are part of the educational culture, if you like. So, I mean, just the very fact that educational researchers are not really part of the in-group, if you like, it's sort of, it's a problem from the outset. And it's not just a bias without some sort of basis. Actually, you know, there is a reason why you might think, well, educational researchers are not necessarily always completely aware of the everyday realities in the classroom. So therefore, people who are in more contact with schools, I mean, that could be professional development companies, or, you know, it could be like the EEF, for example, those sorts of people, when they present research findings, they're more likely to get taken notice of, essentially. So it's not even a matter of what sorts, it's a matter of who, I think, is presenting the research seems to be really important.
And is there like a bit of a culture among, are researchers aware of this, that it's one thing having your paper, having your finding, but to get people aware of it, you've got to know who to get, like slipping them 20 quids and stuff to promote it. Is this a thing?
Well, I think something about 10 years ago, there was a massive move towards impact. It wasn't just in educational research, but it was in research generally. But suddenly, universities were being judged very much, not just on how high ranking the journals were, but actually on evidence of impact.
Yeah.
So there's been a shift, I think, generally in research towards asking, you know, so what? What actually has come from this? All this work has been done, and I think along the way that obviously that has meant that researchers have been also collecting evidence of impact, and I think researchers generally are much more aware of how difficult this is. But it's quite a challenging realization, I think, for many people who are trying to produce, you know, insights into various fields, but including education, to realise how difficult it is to find evidence of impact, you know. And yet how important it is as well. And so I think people who in the past, have, like myself, who've been focusing very much on, you know, providing evidence for hypotheses and things like that, are suddenly saying, what's going wrong here? You know, what are we doing wrong? And how, what is the point of doing research if it's not actually going to end up in the classroom? Yeah. And actually some of what you need to do to make sure your research has some chance of being taken up is right at the beginning, when you're planning the research and thinking about how you're involving other people in the processes of it. So you don't just go away for 3 years and come up with a finding and expect everybody to
to take it on? Because I think that's what's been happening. I think researchers have sort of been doing three-year projects, getting to the end, here are the findings, and then because they're really interesting and potentially important, they kind of expect schools and other people just to sort of take them up, and that, it doesn't happen.
It's interesting, this, just kind of moving between the awareness and understanding kind of aspect of this. I just want to give you three examples. And again, feel free to comment on any of these, Paul. So if you go back, and I can only talk from a secondary perspective, so this may be completely different when it comes to primary and early years in particular. But if you take, I think there's been three things over the last 5 years that have really kind of broken through and made it an actual day-to-day impact in schools. So about 5-6 years ago, Hattie's everywhere with his visible learning and his effect sizes. And I think the reason that that is popular is because there's like a number to it, right? Like if you do this, it's going to have an effect size of this, which is going to translate into you're going to improve your kids' learning by 3 months. And of course it gets completely misinterpreted, but it's, you can, in theory, you can say like the lethal mutation of this, Paul, was you'd get senior leaders were putting notes into teachers' pigeonholes saying, oh, fantastic, I saw you doing this in your lesson. Hattie says that this is going to improve your kids' learning by 4 months and all this. It was really bad. But Hattie was really popular because it's nicely summarized. It's got a nice number to it. You can kind of tick it off as you do it and so on. Fast forward a couple of years later, then Rosenshine gets really popular through Tom Sherrington's work. So everyone's doing Rosenshine's principles of instruction because, again, there's 10 of them. You can kind of tick them off as you're doing them. It's a bit trendy. It's, you can attach names to them and so on and so forth. And then over the last 6 months, and I think this is the best of the bunch, Peps McRae starts doing a weekly newsletter called Evidence Snacks, where he actually goes direct to source. So he will take a paper and he will kind of dissect it in a really accessible kind of 200 word snappy way with some really nice infographics and so on. And I think those three things for me certainly kind of tick the box for awareness, because again, you speak to most teachers, they would have heard of one of, if not all three of those things, Hattie, Rosenshine and Peps. But also in terms of the understanding, what interests me there is, in theory, that work makes stuff much more understandable to teachers. But of course, there's always the danger that you're losing the detail, and particularly with effect sizes, everything getting aggregated together. Maybe some of the kind of specifics and the nuance and those lethal mutations spring out. I just wonder if you have any reflections on any of those things, Paul.
Yeah, well, I think we've seen, yeah, I think the understanding aspect has not been investigated so thoroughly. I mean, there is a lot better understanding of how to draw attention to research findings. But when it comes to the understanding, things are quite a bit more hazy. You're right about the way in which the effect size thing has been misinterpreted. I mean, I've been in an address between a head teacher and his staff where he's used the EEF table on the Educational Endowment Foundation, there is that wonderful toolbox where you can basically sort all the interventions that have been done in terms of their effect size. You just click a button and they get an order of effect size. And he said, these are what you should be paying attention to, and in this order as well.
Yeah, yep.
Which of course, it doesn't quite work like that. I mean, for one thing, some of these interventions are very difficult. Some of them are easy. Some of them are expensive. Some of them are cheap. But also, the notion of effect size itself, it actually depends on the standard deviation. It depends on the spread of the data. So if you do a very noisy one, you're going to get a small effect size. You've got, you know, things happening all over the place. Whereas if you do your intervention in a laboratory where everything is much more ordered and controlled, you're going to get a much bigger effect size. Well, the actual size of the effect in terms of the effectiveness of the intervention, that hasn't changed at all. So, yeah, there is misunderstanding about effect sizes. And I think there's room for misunderstanding about any sorts of research, isn't there? And it does become, I mean, I've reached the point of thinking, well, really, there is no substitute for understanding the why and the how of these ideas. The reason that I don't think there is any prescription about what teachers should do that can be guaranteed to be effective, it's always going to require some underlying understanding of how things are working, not just in terms of the intervention, whatever the or the research findings, but also in terms of what's happening in the classroom. So I think, you know, one of the most important types of research should be understanding how teachers think about learning and what the impact is of that thinking as a result of accessing these sorts of ideas. And there isn't really any research on that at all. I mean, this is what I was totally flabbergasted with when I started working in this area. I thought, well, there's going to be a huge amount of research on how teachers think about learning, so I better put aside a few weeks to try to get to grips with that. There's nothing there. I find that really odd. I'm still coming to terms with it, really, but also trying to do a bit of research on that myself. But so I think, yeah, it's really important to be aware of research, but the understanding of the research is also really important and I think is often neglected.
No, I agree. And just on that, I mean, again, I'll be honest. So I try and read a fair few papers and I try and go to original sources wherever possible. But flipping out, Paul, so some of them are tough. Some of them are dry as anything, right? Is there a kind of a role here for the researchers to up their game a little bit in terms of making it a bit more accessible? And all I'm not talking about dumbing stuff down at all here, but just having some kind of section at the end, like, what does this mean in the classroom? And I know there's always like a discussion section and an implication, but just a nice kind of snappy way to bring it all together. Cause it's just hard to access sometimes, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, actually, without naming names, I was looking at some very popular, widely circulated briefings about research findings for teachers. And I put them through an online, it's sort of an assessment to look at reading difficulties.
Oh, yeah, that's good. So you can just
paste text into it and it gives you a number back and an interpretation. And it came through as, you know, very difficult and you'd have to have a degree or a PhD to be, beyond PhD. It was just very difficult, basically, very difficult to understand these things. And you'd need some sort of PhD or something to be able to. And those are ones that had actually already been developed and honed as a communication to teachers. And, you know, of course, teachers are intelligent people. They've got degrees and qualifications and things. But if you're under pressure to read something quickly without having to refer to other papers or Google lots of words to try to understand what they mean, you know, we are going to have to try harder. We, you know, in terms of actually providing accessible communications. And I think just one of the things is reading difficulty. And, you know, when I was asked to do a report once for the Royal Society, they said, right, executive summary, the reading age has to be no older than 13. And that's not because we've got loads of 13-year-olds reading abstracts from the Royal Society. It's because... You know, you don't want to be spending your time reading the thing. You want to be spending your brain capacity thinking about what this means for you in the classroom. So if you're wrapping it up in a language which is difficult to access in the first place, you've lost your audience, really.
Yeah, as I say, I think it's one of the key barriers. Alongside as well, just the sheer quantity of research that's out there and the fact that a lot of it is locked behind paywalls and so on and so forth makes it difficult for teachers to access. And then if they do access, then to understand. Just kind of moving down this list, Paul, thinking about the value in, I'm quite interested in this as well. and you may not have an answer to this, but do you get a sense, are there any trends of types of research that teachers would value more than, say, other types of research? You mentioned before that early years are particularly interested, of course, primarily in children's well-being more so than anything else. Is there anything else you've picked up there in types of research that tends to be valued more by teachers?
We don't know much about the values. I mean, it's an awful thing to say. But we honestly don't know much about the values of teachers. What is it that gets them out of bed in the morning?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know part of this is having been an ex-teacher myself, I've got some insight into it. But, you know, apart from this you know, very strong belief in the overall well-being of the child and this sort of, you know, valuing of the sort of holistic idea of the child, it's quite difficult to find any evidence for that. But of course, it's also the professional values you have in that sense, you know, in terms of the well-being of the child, but also the personal values, and they are going to interact as well. So, you know, if you see that something is very pro-social, that it has an interactive element to it, so lots of people in the class are getting involved with it, that is going to be, you know, based on some of the research, that gives you a suggestion that people are going to find it more interesting, if you like, and more valued. Whereas if you're asking a child just to go off into the corner on their own and do something on the computer because the researcher has developed something which is very powerful, that may not be so aligned with the values of the teacher, because most, as far as we know, the little research we have tends to suggest that teachers are more inclined towards this idea of social construction of learning. They see it as a social process.
Interesting. On the kind of implementation, adaptation and sustain, just a couple of thoughts on this, and again, feel free to comment, Paul. I think one of the issues here is that as soon as you try something new, not inevitably, but a lot of the time there's going to be perhaps a dip in kind of short-term performance, just in terms of you're getting used to the new idea, the kids are getting used to the new idea, their attention is probably more put on the kind of change in the structure of the thing that you're doing, so less attention goes on to the actual content and so on. And when you instigate a change, particularly if you're a bit nervous about it, and then immediately you see a bit of a dip, you know, the kids don't seem to be getting things as much as you'd hoped, or it's not working as well as you hoped. Like, that feels to me like a real big incentive to say, oh, forget this, let me just kind of go back to what I was doing before. Did you get a sense in this that one of the reasons that perhaps some of this research certainly doesn't get sustained in the long term is because, you know, you get that dip, and if teachers kind of leave before they get that kind of pickup in impact, they don't get to see the fruits of their labor, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the important things about the sustain is the support of colleagues, you know, the existence of networks, a sense that you're not just doing this on your own, because there are going to be times when it's working and times when it's not working. And I think apart from anything, children don't learn necessarily in a linear fashion.
Yeah.
So this idea of sort of overlapping waves where you're going, kids can even appear to be going backwards sometimes before they suddenly jump forward. So I think it's difficult if you're trying to be, you know, resilient to those sorts of setbacks and you're just there on your own trying something. Whereas if you are getting some kudos or some support, or there's some recognition or acknowledgement that you are trying to do something new, that you are doing something which is supported by the school and which is seen as a positive, good thing, it's much easier, I think, to push forward even when you're not quite sure if it's working or not.
Yeah.
So a lot of this comes down to the culture of the school, the ethos of the school in terms of their attitudes to research, which varies, you know, massively from one school to the next. So I think that's quite a big issue, really.
I agree.
You want it embedded in the school as well. So you don't really want this to be something that leaves when you leave.
Yes.
Or, you know, there is a lot of, we have more staff turnover, you know, than ever before at the moment. And
And so if this is something which is going to be a benefit to the school and it's going to be part of the culture and there's a consistent experience for children going from one year to the next as well, then there needs to be mechanisms in place to support new staff arriving who may not be aware of these approaches.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think what would be helpful is if we think in terms of kind of three groups of people here. So I want you to imagine that first, Paul, you're talking to a researcher. So a researcher, they've got this paper. Well, let's say they're about to write this paper up and they want to get it in, so it has an impact in the classroom. So thinking about the kind of six barriers or six steps that we've outlined so far here, what are you saying to a researcher to give their research the best chance of actually playing out into the classroom? How are they getting teachers aware of it? How are they getting them to understand it, value it, interpret it, and so on and so forth? What are you saying to that? Because we'll have lots of researchers listening to this.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I'd say is probably too late now. So I should have thought about
it. Bad news.
Bad news. No, it's not completely too late, but there is a massive advantage to thinking about these things before you even decide what it is that you're researching, because you really want to be attuned to teachers' values in the context that you're hoping to see this operate. You need to make sure that you're identifying something which is understood to be, you know, that can be understood and can be implemented, can be adapted. So I think probably working with teachers from the outset is one of the most important things you can do. I mean, it's no good thinking about this at the writing up stage. I think that is what's been happening. I think the classic thing is for researchers to write up the paper and then think, okay, now how am I going to get this into schools? Because I did write on the grant application that this is going to have some impact in schools. I've got to figure out how I'm going to do that now. That's probably the least effective way of doing it. So making sure that you're researching something which is valued and possibly even, you know, if at all possible, actually, you know, selected and identified by schools as being useful, as being a potentially interesting and helpful approach.
Then
working with schools and educators during the process, and shaping it so that it becomes something which is implementable. But also, of course, while you're doing that, you're going to be collecting, potentially you might be collecting not just evidence of how it's used, but also the means to communicate, because, you know, videos of what it looks like in action, things like that, could all be collected during the research process. And that's really helpful when teachers are trying to grasp what this actually means in the classroom, to actually see it in action. So it's something that needs to be thought about right at the beginning when you're thinking about what sort of research project you might be doing.
It's such a good point, like just on the video thing, and it's an obvious thing to say, right? Exemplifications are always helpful, but I don't think there's anything teachers value more than a video of it in action. And particularly if you've got a couple of examples in different contexts so they can kind of draw out the key active ingredients and stuff. But I don't know about you, I never see that. The only time I ever see it is what you talked about at the start, where you've got a bit of a broker. So you've got someone who's taken a piece of research and thought, okay, this is what it might look like in the classroom, and either written up a scenario or so on and so forth. But I never see it in the original paper. And you're absolutely right. That it'd be so useful, right? It'd break down a lot of those barriers that you've identified.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that appears to work, because it's quite difficult finding evidence of educational research in action that has involved teachers taking on a new approach and has actually improved children's learning. You have to actually be able to show that all those stages all the way through and actually say this has actually impacted on children's learning as well, you know. But one example is Richard Church's work, where he's encouraged the research to be carried out by the schools themselves. And I think, you know, that sort of work really ticks all the boxes. So educator-led experimental research, where you recruit schools, or other teaching schools, actually recruited trial site schools from within their alliances. And that was helpful to begin with, because they were supporting engagement through actually messaging from an in-group. So, you know, the schools were being recruited by schools they already knew, by teachers, if you like. But also, they were asked what did they think were the issues that were important to them. So they had a huge role in negotiating the focus of what was going to be researched. And being trained up as researchers themselves was really empowering and rewarding. And it's all very collaborative. So you've got an immediate network of people that are supporting you in doing the research. And there are, of course, still skilled educators coming in from higher education to sort of scaffold understanding as well. But there's a sense that they're going to value what's coming out much more, because it's emerging through the actions of their own community. They're producing the research. So, of course, they own the research. So of course, they're going to value it. And senior leadership are signed up. They're supporting what's going on, committed to the intervention, or the interventions, should I say, because different schools were doing different things. And it did produce results that where you could see there was an improvement in learning amongst the children. So that's an example of how, you know, research findings have led to an improvement in learning amongst the students.
That's really
and
good.
I think it does reflect very much the approach that was taken. Because it hits all of these things, the understanding, the valuing, the implementation was also, you know, the idea of adaptation was encouraged. It wasn't that they were saying, well, you've got to do this, you've got to do it exactly like that, because otherwise our fidelity will be out the window and we won't be able to write up our research paper. That wasn't the case. So it's a good example, I think, of how a creative approach to research, educational research, can result in research being taken up by educators and improving students' learning.
And who was that again, Paul? What was Church?
Richard Church's.
And what was his area of research?
Well, I mean, I think some of this stuff came out from The Science of Learning. I think that might have been the title. But the schools were actually doing different projects because they were testing out potential interventions that they thought might be helpful for their contexts. And they were researching the impact of those interventions and producing publishable results, you know, along the way.
Nice, nice. Just one more, if you were talking to this researcher. I know we've already said, it's probably too late anyway, should have thought about this before. But let's imagine that they've got a nice paper. It's potentially going to be quite easily implementable in the classroom. It's easy for teachers to understand and so on. Just how do they stand out in an ocean full of other research papers, all trying to get teachers aware of it? Well, what are some ways researchers can actually get their work surfaced?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, you mentioned the readability aspect, because I think that's really important. But I think on their own, it's more difficult. I think they need to be working through a brokerage of some sort or another. And it could be a professional development program. It could be the EEF. They could decide to actually develop a relationship with multi-academy trusts, or a multi-academy trust, and do it through their lines of communication, if you like. But I think what is difficult is just marching into a school and expecting them to apply your results. Really, this needs to come about through networks which are formed as a result of the research, or at least early in the process, as a result through making approaches to, you know, brokers of one sort or another.
Absolutely. All right. So now let's turn our attention. So we've sorted out the researcher. They're loving that, Paul. Next, you're talking to a teacher here. So a teacher who has perhaps come across a piece of research that they find particularly interesting. They value it. They seem to understand it. What advice would you have them in terms of those final three phases, the implementation, the adaptation, and the kind of sustainability of it?
I would first of all just check that it is being published in a peer-reviewed journal somewhere. I mean, quite often you'll come across these findings on websites, or you'll come across them in professional magazines, and they won't themselves be the research publication. They would be hopefully referring to the research, though they should give a very clear reference to where the research is actually published. If they don't, then I would move on. I would just make sure that at least whatever source you're looking at, whatever is making this claim, it is referenced to a research journal. And I would check the abstract just to make sure that that is what the abstract is saying as well. It sounds like the abstract is actually supporting the claims that you've encountered. That would be the first thing. In terms of trying it out, I mean, I think it is important to try to develop a community of people who are doing the same sorts of things. So I think it'd be worth talking to your school about it. Try to get this as senior management on board, or you know, the department, head of department. I mean, of course, you can do things on your own. That's no problem at all. But I think doing this collaboratively. And if you can, if you've got links to the university and possibly to the researchers who actually carried out the original piece of research, because they would probably like to talk to you if you're thinking of actually applying it in the classroom. So I think making those sorts of links and connections and trying to, you know, tap into whatever networks you have, I think that's just quite helpful to so that you're not on your own with it, really.
And in terms of kind of reflecting on your own practice, how it's gone. I'm just thinking there that it's all well and good. You go into a classroom with positive intentions to try things out, but then the kind of the noise of the classroom comes into play and there's all kinds of things. And, you know, then you reflect a couple of weeks later, or has that worked? Hasn't it? It's very hard to kind of distill it from the noise. Just kind of practicalities of how do teachers evaluate what impact something's had? Is it a case of having a piece of paper with you and kind of taking notes throughout the lesson? What have you learned in terms of the teachers who have managed to implement and sustain?
Well, I think the reality is that in most cases, what you're looking at is observation, you know, qualitative sort of notes, and those sorts of things are going to be used to back up your own essential intuition about whether this is happening or not. I think a lot of the most observable behaviours in the classroom are about engagement. There's an awful lot of unseen processes which are very important that you haven't got access to as a teacher, or nobody really has access to unless you've got a brain scanner. But you can often see engagement, and engagement is very important. But ultimately, nothing. This is my personal prejudice coming out here. but it is really helpful to have some sort of quantitative measure of what's going on, and to be able to sort of, you know, compare, you know, marks for tests and homework and that sort of thing. But of course, you know, some of that will reflect on the enthusiasm that the student has towards this new approach as well. It won't just be about understanding, it will be about that emotional response to it. And that's also really important. So I don't think, to be honest with you, I don't think I would want to interfere with the reflective processes of teachers, because I think, you know, given the constraint of time that they have to make these decisions, I think that their approach of using observation, having some time to think about these things and reflect and observation. I mean, I think that's entirely appropriate. If you wanted to take it one step further, then you might be looking at the sort of thing that we just talked about that Richard Churches was doing, where you're actually setting up a randomised controlled trial within your school, which I think is a really splendid thing to do. I would say get some support with it, but from your local university. But that's probably the next level.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And the final group, and again, you've alluded to this throughout the conversation, but let's imagine you're a leadership team within a school, a head teacher, someone in charge of teaching and learning or whatever, and you want to really promote a culture where your teachers are trying innovative research in the classroom. They're not afraid to, you know, take a few risks and so on. How do you foster that culture and that kind of level of support practically?
I think links with higher education are really important there. I think increasingly you're having head teachers who are getting involved with the academic research literature. My impression is anyway. But I think making links with the local university is really important as a guide. Now, I think we've already sort of suggested in a way that, well, I'm not sure we have, but professional development teams tend to be much better at communicating, I would say, on average than researchers. That's, again, my personal bias. I don't have any evidence of that. But I think there is a reason why why professional development teams are accessed and called upon probably more than going to researchers directly when they've got a problem. Actually, there is research on that shows that is the case. It's unusual to try to find, it's more unusual than it should be, finding head teachers who will trace the research back to the higher education institute that actually produced it and get advice there. And that's a shame. I think that needs to happen more. So I would say be very sceptical of some of the findings and claims that you find on the internet. It's really important to go back to the research and find out what's actually been referenced, where it was published, who published it. Get networks with your local university. And also think about how you would sustain the collection of data and the trialing of ideas within your school or schools using quantitative data so you can actually measure whether these things are working or not. I mean, that is increasingly becoming a possibility, and I think that's probably the way to go.
It is interesting. This is absolutely fascinating, this, Paul. I've got one big question I want to ask you now, which could derail everything, so it could all be kicking off after this question, but we'll just see where it goes, right? The way I kind of distill things at the moment is I have maybe 100 teacher blogs that I subscribe to, and I have this like RSS feeder that collates them all every day, and I kind of read through them. Now, they at the moment are my favorite source of ideas for things to try out in the classroom. So I'll give you an idea here. So there's a guy called Pritesh Rachura, and I had him on my podcast. He's a head of science at a secondary school in London. And he has some really interesting practical classroom techniques he tries. So I'll just tell you two of them, then I'll tell you where I'm going with this, Paul. So he does, are you familiar with cold call? The idea that when teachers ask questions, instead of calling for volunteers, the teacher will choose which child to answer. So the way cold call is done traditionally is the kids all sit there and then the teacher says, what is Pythagoras' theorem? Harry, and then Harry has to give the answer. Now, what he does with cold call is he flips it on its head and he asks a question and he calls for every single child to put their hand up in the air. And he says, come on, I need to see everybody's hand in the air, come on. And his theory is that if you do it that way, you get much more energy, you get much more engagement, the kids are much more willing to participate versus a classroom where the kids are all just sat there, hands on their laps, waiting to be cold called. Second example from his, when he asks a diagnostic question where the kids vote with ABCD cards, whereas I traditionally would do ABCD cards, what he does is he asks his students to put their head on their desk, their hand on their head, so they can't see, and then he'll say to the kids, if you think the answer's A, open your palm and close it, okay? If you think the answer's B, open your palm and close it. And the reason he does that is he says that if you have a visible way of voting with ABCD cards, some kids will look at each other's answers and change their answer, or some kids will do like a tactical delay and not vote until they've seen what their mate's going for. So it reduces the validity of the kind of check for understanding. Now, the reason I'm telling you those is they are two super practical things that I can then try out in the classroom myself just as a teacher. But there's zero research findings to suggest that doing cold call, getting all the kids to put their hands up, is any better than doing it with their hands on their lap, or that doing diagnostic questions with heads down, fist on head, is any better than with ABCD cards. So I just wonder, what's your take? Is that, in terms of kind of your view from the research community, is this a good thing that teachers are suggesting techniques that they try and other teachers are adopting them? Or is that problematic because there's no research finding? And then the related question would be, are researchers actively looking at things like this, blogs like this, where they see super practical classroom things and using this as an inspiration for an actual controlled trial to see if that is actually effective? Just wondered if you had any thoughts on either of those, Paul.
I think inevitably this is what's been happening. I mean, it's not, you know, ever since teachers have existed, I'm sure they've been learning from each other. And I think, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier, that is a preferred, teachers would prefer to hear about new techniques in that way than they would going to a research journal and finding out some intervention that's been tried and tested. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because teaching is a very creative business where you've got this constant stream of possibilities and a constant stream of different responses in the classroom, and you're having to sort of spontaneously try and adapt ideas all the time. I mean, you're making a myriad of different spontaneous decisions, aren't you? All of that is fine. It's not like you've got a list, a prescription of exactly what you've got to do. But I think the problem comes in the adapting, in a way, because everything that you do, every idea that you get given, everything that you come across on those sorts of websites, you're going to be trying it out with a different group of children, a different class than the class that it was tried out on by that teacher. It's going to be a different context. So you're going to have to adapt it, and you're going to have to interpret what happens when you try it. And I think that's the bit that's sort of missing, because what you really want to know is why that works and how it works and how it's supposed to work. And that isn't often provided on these blogs. So, I mean, if you think about the cold calling idea, essentially, in a behavioural sense, you could say, well, there's a lot of children who won't answer. They'd rather not, you know. It's easier, isn't it, you know, not to offer a response. So, you know, cold calling is one way around that. But actually, that's going to work for some children. For some children, it's going to be really difficult. If children who are anxious, they're not going to be able to think under those conditions. They're going to find it really difficult. And so you need to be able to interpret that when it happens. And when children start disengaging from the class generally because they're worried about the fact they're going to get asked questions they don't know the answer to, you need to understand why that is and do something about it and possibly change the approach that you've been using. So I think it's great to hear all these ideas, but the thing that's missing is this is from my personal viewpoint. But the thing that's missing is just a basic holistic understanding of how learning works and how, therefore, all of these different interventions sometimes do improve learning and sometimes don't improve learning, and what should be done in those different instances.
Yeah,
it's that understanding of the how and the why of the practice.
What about that flip side, though, of researchers? Is this a thing? Researchers are actively reading teachers' blogs for ideas for research that they could test? Because like some of these, if you think of these six stages that you've gone through, I mean, teachers would be far more aware of some of these ideas that are on blogs or come on my podcast or whatever than they would be for some of the research journals. Is that a thing that's kind of to tick the box of awareness? You take an existing kind of popular teacher idea and you test that out, or is that not how it works?
I think sometimes it works like that. So, for example, interleaving, I think, has been something that's been investigated and they've found that it works. But actually, the processes that underlie it, so interleaving is when you, well, there's different ways of interleaving, but, you know, you could have like an example and then you have like a practice question and then you have an example, or you could have actually interleaving different topics. And these things seem to operate quite well, but we don't really understand how they work yet. But with most interventions, there is some basic set of principles, learning principles, that you can apply to understand them. So I suppose researchers are probably looking at these blogs, but I think they're probably looking at them for examples of the principles that they are researching and trying to understand themselves. So they're looking for the things that they know and understand. And it's pretty much the other way around as well. Teachers look at research, and the research they like the most is the research that tells them what they're already doing is, you know, is good, and that there's some sort of theory behind it. So it's sort of validate what they're already doing, so it's a shame really, because obviously it's the things that you wouldn't expect would work are the most interesting, because that's probably going to produce something, some new, you know, new insight. Both on teachers and research sides, they tend to look for what they want to see. That's human. That's what we do, yeah. Isn't it? It certainly is.
Oh, this is fascinating. So final question just on this, and then we'll bring it together for some reflections. What are you kind of working on either currently or next in this field, Paul? What's exciting you about this idea of getting research into the classroom?
The thing that I think I've sort of said this before, the thing I think we really need to know more about is how teachers think about learning, how that's related to how they teach, and how ideas, you know, insights into learning can actually impact on that in a positive way and produce improved learning. And I think there's real problems in trying to understand that in the classroom. So what I'm working on at the moment, and this is a bit controversial, is a science of teaching, whereby we're actually using online micro teaching as a sort of a micro world of the teaching learning relationship and understanding what happens when you train, or what happens when you provide some teacher education, how that changes practice and how that changes learning. And you can actually study that experimentally to give you some insight into it. And one of the things that we've already sort of found from doing that is that your expertise in one subject does not easily transfer to a new subject. So we're asking people to teach a foreign language 15 minutes that they hadn't come across before. And we found that their experience as a language teacher didn't really seem to help. And I think that's probably indicative of the fact that you can have a theoretical understanding of how learning happens, but so much of learning is automatic. So much of learning is actually rehearsed again and again and again. Sorry, so much of teaching, should I say, is rehearsed again and again and again. You've got these behaviours, and they're really difficult to break out of, because this is how our brains work, and that can really provide some barriers when it comes to taking on new ideas and changing your practice.
Jeez, that sounds absolutely fascinating. That's amazing stuff. Right, Paul. So what I want to do now, I want to ask you one kind of just general reflection question. And again, as listeners will have heard before, you haven't prepped for this, so you'll do well to produce this off top of your head anyway, but we'll just see where we go. And that is there an example of something important that you've changed your mind about over the last few years?
Oh, yeah. I think really that it does come down to this idea of trying to work out how teachers are thinking about their practice. I think that's probably more important. So I've been working on neuroscience and education, and it's been all about how neuroscience can change practice in the classroom. So what will neuroscience give us in terms of new insights? What new practices will arise as a result of neuroscience? And actually, I don't think it's a matter of new practices. I think the most important thing is to try to get example, is try to have insight into the old practices and try to work out how these quite well-established practices, like the Rosenstein practices, for example, operate and how teachers think they operate. And I think just the insight into everyday practice and how teachers think about everyday practice is probably the most urgent thing that we need to know. It's not about shiny new practices coming through from neuroscience, which is difficult for me to say because I'm a professor of neuroscience and education. But there you go.
That's really good. I love that. Good, great answer. Great answer. Right. So final thing from me, Paul, is what's your big three? So this is three either websites, blog posts, whatever you want that you recommend listeners check out. And I'll put links to each of these in the show notes.
Okay, well, I would say you must go to the Semmel website because the Centre for Early Mathematics Learning, which is, well, you're going to give those links, so I don't need to say them, do I? But the Centre for Early Mathematics Learning, that has now started. They've got their website is up, and there's going to be lots of new interesting things on that site for chiefly for primary school early years teaching in early maths. More generally, for everybody, I would direct people towards the Science of Learning website that we've set up, which has got videos about how learning happens in the classroom. But it's also got some videos of new teachers being mentored and being encouraged to reflect on their practice. And those videos, I think, are quite difficult to find of that type. So I'm really proud that we've got some annotated videos supported with some documentation about how teachers learn to reflect on their practice.
That sounds amazing. Is that a Loughborough one, or is that who's kind of set
It
that
came
up?
from a Wellcome Trust project that was set up a few years ago. That project's now ended, but we use it in our on our PGCE, and it's got links to the early career framework as well, so you can see how these ideas are linked to the DfE frameworks, and lots of videos and resources on there.
Sounds brilliant.
And then I suppose the last thing I would say, go out and buy my book, which is called Evolution of the Learning Brain. And it's a book that was written for teachers, although it's kind of like has a popular science readership, I think. And it tells you everything you need to know about how the brain learns, but through the narrative, through the story of evolution. So it starts off 3.5 billion years ago and ends up with will our brains cope with climate change?
Wow. Oh, that sounds absolutely brilliant. And I tell you, it's a good testament to your ego, Paul, that you haven't put that at number one of the big three. Most people do there. They put their own book first. That's
Well,
good.
leaving to the best to
Best till
the
last. I like it. I like it. Well, I tell you what, Paul, this has been an absolute pleasure. This for a man who'd done no prep, you've chatted for well over an hour there about that. So that was, really, really enjoyed that. And I'm sure listeners
pleasure.
will love listening to it. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.